And so, speaking of natural progression, Jim, they captured the moon, parked it 272,000 miles or whatever away from Earth. Why? I mean, we don't know, but you got any theories or ideas or hypotheses?
Well, once you start coupling up some of the things we do know, such as the story of ancient astronauts, and you'd think, well, how did they get here? And the idea of a little rocket ship, that's why scientists have poo-pooed the idea of people coming from another solar system or another galaxy because of the distances involved. And of course, a little ship could not carry enough fuel to do something like that. But of course, that's based on the idea that they would be using our primitive rocket systems. And there's a lot of people in the know today who realize and are arguing that jet engines are a thing of the past. This is what we still see in the movies, and we still see blasting off Cape Canaveral with space shuttles and things like that. But there's a growing number of people who are claiming that we already have a secret space fleet that's operating with anti-gravity devices. And so that has certainly been under study for a long time. And I think it's entirely possible that if we have something like that, then some advanced civilization that's older than ours may have come up with that a long time ago. And if they did, and if they're going to have an interstellar flight that was going to take a long time to go, then you'd need a huge vessel. And the idea seems to be, in fact, Carl Sagan, early in his career, along with some Russian scientists, were claiming that Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, appeared to be hollow. And as Carl Sagan noted, a natural object cannot be hollow. And so the idea is that they take a huge asteroid or a moonlet, and then they burrow inside of it, and then using, I don't know, heating devices or particle beam laser type weapons, they hollow it out. And then this could explain all of the maria on the moon, which are, they call the moon seas, and the material on the surface of the moon, interestingly enough, is denser than the material inside the moon. In fact, before going to the moon, the scientific community told us that these maria and some of these craters may have been the result of volcanic activity on the moon, and yet when they got there, they found out there is no volcanic activity on the moon. So it leads to the speculation that someone went inside the moon and hollowed it out using advanced technology, melted down the core of the moon, and then poured it out onto the surface, which would harden it and would then make it a artificial satellite. And then they could send that go moving through the cosmos. And if you did that, you would expect that it would be picking up debris in space, kind of like bugs on the windshield. And sure enough, one side of the moon bulges as opposed to the other side and has a denser layer of dust and material, exactly as you would expect, as if it had traveled through space for a long time. So it's really amazing, but these are things that I find very fascinating, and this is what I write about in my book, Our Occulted History. But most people don't even think about it because they're never told about these things.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if there's still some people inside the moon now. I mean, that's of
Exactly.
extraterrestrial origin.
Well, and Jerry, that's not just idle speculation, because going back to the invention of the telescope, all through the centuries, people have reported seeing lights moving on the surface of the moon and things moving. In the early 50s, they said they found a bridge on the moon that was spanning a deep chasm there, and everybody looked and they saw it, and then a few months later, it wasn't there anymore. And so
Yeah.
it's like, wait, what's going on? And I recall one time that I had occasion to interview Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth astronaut to walk on the moon. And he was being very open about things. And in fact, he said he acknowledged that some of our advanced technology of today was gained through alien technology. He has said that publicly. But I asked him, I said, well, you know, some people say the moon might be hollow. I said, what do you think about that? And he initially scoffed and said, no, the moon's not hollow. You know, okay. But then he went on to say that although we do know that it's lighter inside the moon and heavier on the outside of the moon, and he said, so we are now thinking there may be giant caverns inside the moon. Well, you know, here's the sixth guy to walk on the moon. I didn't want to argue with him, but I was sitting there thinking, well, wait a minute, a hollow moon, giant caverns within the moon, what's the difference?
Right, right. Terminology, is all just a little semantics there, but...
Well, if you say giant caverns in the moon, then that most people, they take that as that could be a natural occurrence. But if you say a hollow moon, then that has the connotation of being manufactured somehow. So I think
yeah,
that's
pretty well. You're right on with that, of course. We're talking with Jim Mars, folks, and we got a lot of things to discuss yet. I want to pick up what we're talking about now. Just like Jim Mars, I find ancient astronauts and all of this activity going on around is just fascinating. It's so interesting that I don't even know where to pick up many times. In your book, what do you cover?
Just about everything.
Okay.
In fact, I go back, go all the way back to the Big Bang and then bring it all the way forward. But since the evidence for ancient astronauts is so overwhelming, and then we throw in all of these sites around the world that most people have never heard of or don't know much about, and I guess one of the most famous, of course, would be the Great Pyramid of Egypt. And, of course, we do know about that. And... But others like Göbekli Tepe over in Turkey, which is recently discovered, the Osirian. I'd never heard about the Osirian. The Osirian is ancient ruins that are only visible underground, they're below ground, under Seti's temple in Egypt. And so,
by when you say only visible, what exactly do you mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, we went to Abydos in Egypt, and we wanted to go visit Seti's palace. So we were there looking through this huge ancient place with all the ancient hieroglyphics and everything. And one of the guides said, do you want to see the Osirian? And I'm going, well, wow, what's the Osirian? So he takes us out back, and you go out back and down underneath Seti's palace are these giant monolithic stones placed in all columns, and there's even a cistern, and there's a waterway, and these things are huge, huge. I mean, I don't think even modern science would probably have a hard time placing these huge stones, and they are so perfectly cut that I didn't notice any mortar being used at all. They just fit right up next to each other. And these obviously predate Egypt. And another thing I found interesting is they have cross pieces, and they kind of look like they were placed like Stonehenge, except Stonehenge looks like very rough and weathered stone. These are all perfectly cut granite blocks, and they are placed just one right next to each other. And there are no hieroglyphics on this. So this, to me, obviously predates the Egyptians. Plus, it's underwater a lot of the time, which is why most people, when they go, even if they know about the Osirian and they want to see it, you can't get down in there because there's water covering the place. But I just happened to hit on a very fortunate time when they were having kind of a drought, and there was still water standing down in there, but at least you could see it. However, I might point out, we had to bribe guards because there was a wooden stairway leading down into this Osirian, and that had 2x4s crossed it, so you couldn't go down there. And so this is not normally open to the public, and it wasn't open then. But we paid a little backsheesh to the guard, and he actually pulled the 2x4 away and let us go down these stairs into this area, and we wandered around for for some time, and I took some pictures. And then the next thing I know, some guard's hollering at us, and he comes down, so we had to pay him too. And we continued to probe around a little bit. And then finally their gang boss or the lieutenant or somebody showed up with a machine gun and said, everybody get out of there. And I think he was just mad because nobody bribed him. But so we had to get out. But there it all was. And it's an amazing place. And that's just one of the places. Göbekli Tepe is another one like that. Machu Picchu, of course, which a lot of people know about, but very few people have actually gone there.
Where is that?
That's in South America, in Peru, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And up in the mountains. In fact, I'm always amazed at the stories of Machu Picchu because it reminds me of the biblical story of Ezekiel, who was taken up in what he could only describe as the image of God. In other words, it was something he couldn't explain. But it took him up, and it flew him somewhere, and it flew him to this ancient city that was up in some mountains. Well, I don't know of any city in the mountains over in the Middle East, so I keep thinking that it might have been Machu Picchu, because the evidence seems to be that at one point there was a worldwide civilization that covered all of the continents of the earth. And of course,
the worldwide civilization. How about
right.
The Western Hemisphere?
Not just the Western Hemisphere, the entire world.
Okay.
And I think that this has come down to us merely as legends and vague accounts, and we have come to know it as Atlantis. And of course, the big argument about Atlantis is that, there are so many different theories. One is that it was a giant island in the middle of the Atlantic, another that it's located off of Bimini in the Caribbean, and another that it was actually Antarctica before a pole shift and it was covered with ice. Others say it's the island of Santorini or other islands there in the Mediterranean, and there's even one theory that says it was in the South China Sea. And the thing is, my thought is that this is like the blind men and the elephant. They all have a piece of it, and none of them are right, but none of them are wrong. I think it was part of a worldwide civilization, and I think it was the energy source sent along via pyramids. Because we now know, there are the pyramids on the Giza Plateau in Egypt. There are pyramids in South America built by the Aztecs. There's pyramids in Central America built by the Mayan. There are pyramids in China. And now they're even finding these giant pyramids in Eastern Europe. So I think it was a worldwide civilization. And for whatever reasons, either war and or geophysical catastrophes, I think it fell into barbarism. And I think we lost a lot of that technology. And I think we're only just now today regaining the technology enough to recognize that technology for what it was.
That's a very interesting and challenging hypothesis you have there, Jim. It's, you could be right. In fact, you probably are.
Well, it answers all of the anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
And it also answers why that all of these things, I'm sure you're well aware of the huge pyramids and the huge roadways and walls that they found under the ocean off of Okinawa and then off of Bimini and off of other places around the planet. And, what was all that? Are these civilizations we've never heard of, or do they belong to one advanced civilization that was long destroyed before our written history began?
You know, the way you lay that out, Jim, it appears it probably was an advanced civilization that was worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And from intergalaxy.
Yeah, and what was this advanced civilization? Well, again, you got to listen to these these primitives and their ancient stories and their legends. You know, the gods came from the sky. In fact, that's an interesting thing there too, really. They all have a name for them, Quetzalcoatl or you know, or the Anunnaki or the great whatever, you know. And yet, so the language changes, but the personalities and the descriptions of these folks all remain the same. In our book, Our Cultured History, I pointed out that the gods of Sumeria, Enki and Enlil, and the gods of the Egyptians, Thoth and Anubis, Ra, and then you move to the Greeks with Zeus and Hera and, you know, all of Aphrodite. And then those translate then when the Romans became the predominant civilization. Then it became the Roman gods, Mars, the god of war, Jupiter, the main god, you know. And yet when you stop and look, the characterizations and the personalities are exactly the same. It's just the names change because of the language change. So were these ancient people actually talking about real living beings who came here and lived on Mount Olympus or off somewhere where the normal people couldn't get to them, maybe in orbit, you know?
Yeah, they may have been on the moon, in the moon.
Uh-huh.
Jim Mars is our guest. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we're on Inception Radio here. Might also check out my website, jerrypippin.com. All of these shows are there on demand as well. And a live coverage as well. So, in fact, we repeat the show tonight at 11 o'clock Eastern, 8 o'clock Pacific. So if you tuned in late, and this certainly would pique your interest, I'm sure, then go ahead and listen to the whole show beginning at 11 o'clock Eastern tonight, the replay. And then if you can't do either of that, you can listen to it at your convenience at jerrypippin.com. Also, Inception Radio has a good podcast section as well, and we have a link to it, by the way, on our website to help you out. Mike Lucas and Bob Tarmack, along with Joe Champion, are the board of directors of Inception Radio. We just wanted to take time to salute them for really being a pioneer on paranormal and UFO radio. They concentrate on that almost exclusively. Okay, now, Jim, let's get back to your book here for a minute, The Occult and History. It's an intriguing title, and as soon as you explained to me why you called it that, and the light lit up, you know, all of a sudden, this got a lot of potential.
Right. Well, what I've also done, and here's, you know, there's a lot, you can get a lot of books pertaining to the ancient astronaut thesis, including the 12 or 14 books written by Zachariah Sitchin, who passed away here in the last couple of years, and was probably the instigator of a lot of this, along with the Swiss journalist von Däniken, who actually had been promoting this ancient astronaut thing for a long time. And initially both of them were booed and scoffed at, you know, but as time goes on and there's more and more discoveries are being made, and especially now that more people are becoming aware of the topic thanks to the Ancient Aliens series on TV, we find that it's a valid subject for discussion and study. Okay, so, but what I've done here in Our Occulted History is my working question was, does this ancient aliens theory, can it be connected to another predominant theory of today, which you and I have talked about at some length, which is, I guess, best described as the New World Order. The idea that a handful of people are at least trying to control the economies and hence the governments of the world. And I might point out that this is pretty much also beyond dispute, just like ancient astronauts. For example, in 2011, there's a study by the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, and they studied 43,000 multinational corporations. And they found that these 43,000 multinational corporations were controlled by a mere 1,318 companies. And all of these had interlocking ownership. Now, these 1,300 companies, in turn, were controlled by only 147 interlocking firms. And collectively, they controlled more than 60% of global revenues. And of these 47 interlocking firms, most of them were controlled by one of 20 banks, multinational banks, that also had cross directorships and ownership. And what's wild, Jerry, is that this was simply using business and corporate statistics. They pointed out, the Swiss scientists pointed out, that their study did not even attempt to analyze the family and social or other relationships of these owners and stockholders in these 20 banks. So you got 20 banks that control the world. Now, that's pretty tight central control.
Yes,
it
is.
And so there's really no question that we've got this inner circle of people who are at least trying to run the world. So my question was, can they be connected in any way to this idea of ancient astronauts? And surprisingly enough, the answer is yes. For example, we know at the top of the banking financial chain is the Rothschild banking dynasty, started back in the 1700s by Meyer Rothschild, and then he sent his six sons out, and before long they became heads of the central banks of England, France, Germany, Austria, Italy, okay? And that between them, they instigated booms and bust, wars and revolutions. In fact, the war between the states here in the United States has been largely attributed to Rothschild manipulation. They had one of their minions, a Dr. Bickley, who came over here and began to stir up the North-South pro-slave, anti-slave issue by forming a secret society known as Knights of the Golden Circle. John Wilkes Booth, the assassin of President Lincoln, was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. In fact, so was Sam Houston for a time. And it was the Knights of the Golden Circle that really helped agitate for the violence that followed. Now, likewise, they had another employee who was a registered Rothschild agent who came over here and soon became managing the war effort for the Republican government of the North. And at the same time, he was buying up the stock of the South. So they were pitting these two sections of the country against each other, and it, of course, resulted in the war between the states. It's really amazing. So what's the connection between the Rothschilds and these ancient astronauts? Well, in the 1920s, the Rothschilds named one of their descendants Nimrod, because they claim that they are the descendants of the ancient Sumerian god king Nimrod, who claimed to be the offspring of a human wife and a godlike father who came from the stars. Hello. And so then you continue to go on, and you find that the Roman leaders, Sulla, for example, founded a college in Rome dedicated to the Egyptian goddess Isis, who is also known as Hathor to the Egyptians, Venus, or Aseroth to the Sumerians. So again, we see that they're tracking all the way back through the Greeks to the Egyptians, back to the ancient Sumerians. In fact, the German word Kaiser and the Russian title Tsar are all just derived from the Roman, from the Latin word for king, which was Caesar. And it's all in the bloodline. For example, there's a common link in this bloodline as Philip of Macedonia, who married Olympias, and their son was Alexander the Great. And then we see that Geoffrey de Bouillon of France's House of Lorraine became the Crusader King of Jerusalem and founded the mysterious Priory of Sion, and also was involved with the creation of the Knights Templars. Now, both George Herbert Walker Bush and his wife Barbara are related to Geoffrey de Bouillon. In fact, what is amazing, and this is just really raises my question mark, is that going back to the selection of 2000, there was a story from Burke's Peerage, which is a very prestigious genealogical publication in England, that was predicting that George W. Bush would become president over Al Gore. Because, in their words, quote, the presidential candidate with the most royal genes and chromosomes has, up till now, always won the White House. And they said while both Bush and Gore were related to the Windsors, the royal family of England, the Bush family was more closely connected. And, of course, as we now know, even though Gore won the election, the Supreme Court stopped the recount and appointed George W. Bush as president, so Burke's Peerage prediction became true. Well, now, that's pretty wild, but now grab this. So now you would think, well, at least now we've got Barack Hussein Obama in there, and boy, surely he has no relationship to the Bushes or the Cheneys. Ah, but au contraire. Lynn Cheney, the wife of Dick Cheney, while studying and preparing a book on Dick Cheney's family history, found that Obama is a descendant of Maureen Duval, a French Huguenot whose son married the granddaughter of a Richard Cheney, who had arrived in Maryland in the late 1650s from England. So Obama is a cousin to Dick Cheney. And then, according to the Chicago Sun-Times, that both Obama and Cheney are blood relations to the Bush family. According to the paper, George W. Bush and Obama are 10th cousins once removed, and they're linked through a 17th century Massachusetts couple, Samuel Hinckley and Sarah Sewell. Now, Hinckley is a distant relative of George Herbert Walker Bush's close friend, John Warnock Hinckley Sr., whose son, John Warnock Hinckley Jr., was the man who shot President Reagan in 1981. Now, does that go beyond the pale of acceptability or what? How could that be?
We're going to take a break here, Jim. Yeah, that was an amazing fact. I want to come back and talk to you about some other things. And you piqued my interest for sure. Always enjoy having you on. Folks, we still have lots of show to go, so don't go away. I'm Jerry Pippin. Our guest is Jim Morris.
You're listening to IRN, the Inception Radio Network, Chicago, Illinois.
Hello, Inception Radio Network listeners. This is Amanda. Remember, you can take your Inception Radio shows on the go. Just download the Inception Radio Network app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android smartphones and access live shows, past shows, guest lineups, and much more. Just visit the iTunes Store or the Google Play Marketplace and download it today for free.
Don't have a computer? Is your internet connection down? Don't worry. Use your trusty cell phone or landline and call into our listen line at 401-283-6700 to listen to the Inception Radio Network 24/7. Again, that call-in number is 401-283-6700. For the Inception Radio Network, I am MJ.
You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat.